The Book Nook on WISO is made possible by six local library systems in Southwest Ohio: the Greene County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Midpoint Library System, Clark County Public Library, the Dayton Metro Library, and the Wright Memorial Public Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and it's my pleasure to welcome back to the program today C.B. McKenzie. His new novel is called Burn What Will Burn. Hello, McKenzie. How you been?
Hi, Vic. Well, irregular, I guess, but I'm okay.
Yeah.
It's been kind of an up and down few months, but the book's doing good.
Where are you?
I'm back in Texas.
Uh-huh.
So I've kind of relocated to Texas after about a year and a half, 2 years in California.
Uh-huh.
And I'll be here, I guess, another year. I was in Iceland last summer, and I'm trying to finish up my third book, the Iceland book, before Christmas. So
that's right. I remember you talking about that Iceland book last time we had you on the show.
Yeah, we went over and stayed 2 months, rented a house and kind of integrated into the community, insofar as that's possible in Iceland. They're not the warmest people in the world. It is Iceland, though.
I hear it's beautiful.
It's gorgeous, but one of the reasons that it's so gorgeous is there aren't any trees. I've never been any place where there's nothing, there's no tree-like thing. You know, I lived in the desert for years, but there's scrub brush and there's saguaros. But Iceland has virtually no trees. In fact, the joke there, they say, if you get lost in the forest, just stand up. Because there's not a tree any higher than 4 foot tall.
They got lots of thermal activity there, too.
Where we were in West Fjords is not a high thermal level activity place. We were right up on the Arctic Circle.
Oh, wow.
In the kind of peninsula up there. I call it the Arkansas of Iceland. And in fact, my editor, Peter Joseph, he said, well, we were talking about what my identity was or what my brand was. And he said, I think you just write about marginal places. So wherever I happen to find them, I think that's probably one of my identifiers as a writer.
Well, you've certainly found one in this new novel, and it is Arkansas. How did you get the idea for this story, Burn What Will Burn?
Last time we talked, I think I mentioned that my first published novel, Backcountry, was actually my 10th novel, which means there are 9 others sitting around. This is one of those.
I see.
So I went to college in Arkansas, and up in the northwest part of Arkansas, the tailbone of the Ozarks, in a little mountain range called the Boston Mountains, at Arkansas Polytech, it was back then. It's Arkansas Tech University now. And I actually lived in Bob Reynolds' house and lived on the Little Piney, and this was my neighborhood. And so when I went to graduate school, I had an older book that was probably from 95, and it had been my opus. You know, 500 or 600 pages of everything I thought about everything, and it was in this setting. I had set it in this place in Arkansas, and it was called the Cousin Club, and it was populated with a bunch of wild cousins, and it had some satanic killings and various and sundry weirdnesses about it. It eventually whittled down to the book that became Burn What Will Burn, and so I kept the setting, and I just changed all the characters. So this is about the third or fourth version of what originally was a book called The Cousin Club, which no longer exists.
Sounds like you tossed out all the satanic stuff.
It really sort of reduced to more family. It's about relationships. I know that sounds odd if you read the book. Bob is pretty disconnected from the world, but it's about what people do for their people, for better or worse, and what people do to other people. And it doesn't have any Satanism. there's killing and there's weirdness, but there's no satanic cult anymore. That was gone.
And you're saying you lived on this body of water in this house?
Lived in Bob Reynolds' house. I had chickens on the front porch, and this is actually my house. And we lived exactly 1 point, whatever it was, miles to Little Piney Creek. It's a gorgeous place. I mean, it is back country. It is really, really out in the boonies, but it's absolutely, absolutely gorgeous. So, I just kind of kept that setting, and and worked the book around. So this was actually my MFA thesis.
Oh.
And it's kind of a little bit of revenge that it's getting published and getting reviewed, and we're talking about it on a great radio station because nobody in my MFA program liked it. It was kind of a flop.
And that was in Arkansas?
No, it was at the University of Arizona.
Oh, okay.
I got both my MFA and my PhD at the University of Arizona. So the first book was really my where I lived during graduate work from 98 to 2008 or whatever it was in Tucson. And I worked in South Tucson in the municipality called South Tucson, and that was bad country. That's where
right.
It comes from, on the Pascua-Yaqui Nation and Donna Odom reservations there. That was my neighborhood, Barrio Historico. And this precedes that, so this is actually my where I went to undergraduate. And all my people are from southern Arkansas. They're all from the Delta region of Arkansas. So I've been in and around Arkansas for, you know, all my life. And go to Hot Springs regularly. That's one of the places that Bob kind of retreats to. And it's one of my favorite retreats as well.
The book is Burn What Will Burn. C.B. McKenzie joins us. And you said that you were living in Bob's house, but you also said we, so apparently you weren't Bob because you were living there with somebody else, and Bob is a loner.
Yeah, there's usually been a we around, so I was living there with who became eventually my first wife, and we lived in this house that it got so cold in the winter, it was uninsulated. Well, let me say this first. The people that were living in the house before us weren't people. People raised pit bulls in this house. We moved into this house out in the country. And the summer was so hot, we had to build a little tent in the front room and use our 5,000 BTU air conditioner to have a little oasis out of the 100-degree heat. And then in the winter, it got so cold, the paneling actually bucked off the walls. It froze, and just the paneling came off the walls. That was this place. Yeah.
Well, it sounds like Bob's neighbors were living there. They were dog people. Let's talk about this neighborhood where Bob lives and how the book opens, because Bob is just strolling along minding his own business, and then he sees something he really doesn't want to see.
Yeah, it's a friend of mine calls this a detective book without any detective in it.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of accurately describes the plot on a level, because Bob finds himself in a circumstance. And then we kind of go backwards from there, and there's probably Bob has a bit of a backstory that might not implicate him directly immediately in this discovery of the dead body in the Little Piney Creek. But as the story unfolds, we see that there are probably more threads connecting him than are at first apparent. One reviewer said that this book is kind of like gin. It looks real clear, but then you take a couple of drinks and things get a little bit cloudier. And I think that's kind of how it works.
Uh-huh.
It's kind of a tricky little book. It's a short book, and it's a real fast read. I think that's why people are enjoying it. And a lot of people are enjoying it more than the first book, because the first book was a more difficult read. This is not a hard read. But I think if you just skim the surface, you'll miss that there's a lot of plot structure underneath that surface. So, yeah, Bob just kind of blunders into this, and he's not a conventional amateur detective because he does not want to detect anything. Most amateur detectives really seem driven by something. Either someone's asking them to do something or they're getting, you know, there's some gain for them. But for Bob, he would really rather push the body back into the creek and just forget about it. And I think he would probably regret often that he just didn't do that. As often we do in life, you know, we just say, man, I wish I hadn't done, you know, if I had just done one little thing that probably wasn't right, it probably would have saved me a lot of trouble down the line.
Well, Bob, for one thing, he's independently wealthy. He's got a good stash of money. He's not going to run out of money. He doesn't need to work. He drinks a lot and just kind of hangs out. And he's if there's anything that he's interested in, it's this woman, Tammy Faye. He's interested in her, and this is kind of a fatal attraction set up for him, isn't it?
Yeah, she's kind of femme fatale, and I think of her as a bit of a stock character when I first introduced her into the story. She's got a complexity, though, in her backstory, too, that links her to this community in ways that are rather nefarious, let's say. And there's a lot of underhandedness in this small community, which was not actually present in the community that I lived in. But there was this kind of undercurrent of there's a connectivity between all of these people that leads them into some problems. It forms a kind of community that's not. It looks all right on the surface, but underneath the surface, there are some really bad things going on, I think.
Well, it's one of these communities where you've got your holy rollers, and then you've got all these people that are secretly connected and all these scandals lurking beneath the surface. I always like to pick out a peripheral character that's my favorite, and in this book, I would say it has to be the doctor.
Yeah, Doc's got a good personality. I'm not going to say he's a good person, but he does kind of have a good personality. And he's a voice of reason, but one that if you listen to it in a thoroughgoing way, you're going to get real messed up, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm.
He's, on the surface there again, he seems like the person that's directing things, and in a way he is, and it seems like he's leading us to some kinds of reasonable conclusions. But then as we find out about him, there are these underpinnings in his structure that kind of undermine him as a Moses, you know what I mean? As a conventional, he's the leader of a community. But if you're the leader of a bad community, that's going to make you a bad person. So even if you're fundamentally sound as the leader of that community, if this makes any sense, your reputation in that community, this is what I teach students, is that your ethos in the community can be a bad character. If you're running with a bad gang and you're the leader of that gang, being bad is good, if that makes sense. So I think what the doc has is a very thorough understanding of how the community works. Bob does not have this understanding because he is an outsider. And Doc is really that connection for Bob to that community of which he's not really a part.
We also have a rather endearing character, this Malcolm, the grandson, and I actually like his grandfather, too, the preacher.
Yeah, Malcolm was originally a more kind of comic figure, and he's a conventional, in a way, he's a conventional foil for a kind of character like Bob, because Bob is sensitive to the world in a way without caring about it, if that's understood. He's a poet. He has a poet sensibility, mm-hmm. So he recognizes certain things around him that a lot of people are not going to recognize. One of those things is Malcolm, and Malcolm's kind of, he has a kind of goodness, but on the other hand, there are things about Malcolm. He's part of the same community that's bad. So, for instance, he wants to know where his inheritance is. You know,
mm-hmm.
he understands what money is. He's not so naive that he doesn't understand. Bob has money, and he doesn't. And he doesn't quite understand why that's fair, if that's understood. He's not a simple character, I don't think. I think some people have kind of identified him as this, you know, happy-go-lucky kid, but I think if you read him more closely, he's got the same kind of complexity, and in ways sort of the same kind of it's not really evil in him, of course, but it's a self-absorption, you know. It's a self-centeredness. He wants what he wants for himself and his world. And so does his grandfather. I mean, his grandfather has a certain vision for the community. But there are probably many things that the good reverend will do that a lot of people would think in conventional sense are criminal, you know, including probably taking care of some business with his relatives, even some very close relatives. He might very well have done that. But he's so righteous about himself and so self-righteous that I think he can easily justify whatever he's done as does, you know, the will of God, because the will of God, of course, is his will.
When I think about books that are set in Arkansas. I guess the name that comes to mind is someone like Daniel Woodrell. And when you read his books and when you read this one, you kind of get the idea that these rural areas have a lot of drug activity. Is that true?
I think part of the reason this book is set in the mid-80s is that a lot of that didn't exist. So the drug activity that was there was really just weed. There weren't meth labs back then. A lot of grit lit now is just dominated by meth heads doing meth head things.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times that just leads to more or less senseless violence. There's not even an organization to it like there is, say, in the heroin trade or the cocaine trade. There aren't those masterminds. There's just these crazy people out in trailers in the woods cooking up meth and blowing themselves up half the time,
mm-hmm.
you know. And there's not a lot of that in there. There's a little weed in the background. When I lived in Arkansas, the second largest cash crop in Arkansas, I think after soybeans, was marijuana. And because it was a good place to grow it, and there are a lot of haulers. I mean, there are a lot of places to hide weed. Of course, now nobody cares about this much anymore, but back then it was a big deal. And also, wherever there's isolation, whether on the reservation, out in the middle of the desert, or, you know, in a rural area, or in a ghetto where you don't have a lot of connectivity with the scene, with things that are going on and happening, or, you know, church and school and stuff like that, people get bored.
Mm.
And there's just a lot of, I mean, you see this with Bob. Bob is just, he doesn't have a lot of things to keep him occupied, you know, and he discovered that money really doesn't do that. I think money for some people really does. I think money is a great entertainment for some people. If I had a lot of money, I think I would be pretty constantly entertained. I don't think Burn What Will Burn's going to get me to that position, but maybe I'll come up with a better idea eventually.
My guess
I'm a storyteller, so you never know when you're going to come up with a good story if you're a storyteller. I'm not one of those guys who's focused on the process. You know, I'm not really into being a writer and living the writer's life and thinking about writing all the time. I have an idea about a product, and that's a book, and it's got a certain shape to it, and I want to achieve that. And in that way, I'm really a conceptual writer, and so that's why my first two books are standalones, and I haven't gone with the series. And my third book, then, is a totally different direction and written in a different style, the Iceland book, the same, but white's going to be very different than the first two.
In case you just tuned in, my guest is C.B. McKenzie. His latest novel is Burn What Will Burn. And we've been hearing something sounds like an ice cream truck in the background. Have you been, like, walking away from the base, or what is that sound?
That's my wind chime.
Oh, okay. That's your wind chime.
Wind chimes.
Well, I wish it was an ice cream truck.
Yeah. It's nice today, but it was 4th of July weekend, you know, it was 101, so it's pretty hot here.
What part of Texas are you in?
I live in northeast Texas on Lake Gladewater, actually, so it's a little town. I was born and raised there, and my mom's on the side of the library there. She raised the money in 73 to build the library, and so we've got long roots in this part of the country.
And this book, the fact that it was one of those drawer books, how did you decide this was the one that you were going to try to publish next? How did that happen?
I really didn't. My editor, Peter Joseph at St. Martin's, I think he was shocked that Bad Country did as well as it did. I'm probably telling on him, but
yeah,
it did a little bit better. And I'm not saying it did well. It's just like it did better than we thought it was going to do. And so I was back in California, and he sent me an email, and he said, he knew I was working on the Iceland book, but he says, do you have anything else? Because I'm not working really fast, you know.
Uh-huh.
I've already written 10 books, and it's going to take me a year and a half, 2 years to do a book. I'm not going to be one of those two books a year kind of guy. And so he kind of said, do you have anything else? And I said, well, yeah, I've got 10 books in the trunk.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, send me what you think we can work with the most easily. And this is a very compact book, and Burn What Will Burn's a book that I've always liked. It just, nobody's ever read it. You know, it didn't get out there. Nobody ever saw the thing. I couldn't ever get anybody to read it. And I sent it to Peter Joseph, and he got back to me within a week, and he says, I'll take this one and three more.
Oh, my.
So he liked it. And he doesn't mind me also. We've discussed this before. he likes concept books, and not that these are high concept books, they're not, but books that are kind of informed by things other than just developing a brand. I mean, he's all for developing a brand as well, but I think he and I both kind of come to the conclusion that my brand as a writer really is to be an original and a unique voice in crime writing, you know, in crime fiction, and to write literary books that can all be standalone if they need to be. And so that gives me an option to kind of do what I want to do. But I've got a serial killer western sitting in the trunk, and I've got a book about my modeling days. I've got a serial killer book about modeling in Milan from the 1990s. And there's all kinds of crazy stuff there. And this was just, to me, the most manageable. And also, this is a book, Vic, that since it's in first person, and I typically don't do first person, and it's a poet protagonist, it really suited the lyrical language of the book, if that makes sense. It's not overwritten because it's not me writing it. It's Bob Reynolds, who is a poet. So the fact that he is kind of operating in this lyrical style as he walks through his dailiest of days makes sense. And that kind of allowed me to write in the style that I enjoy, but that I normally wouldn't indulge in because it can be an affectation.
So after the success of Bad Country, Peter wanted to make sure that there was stuff in the pipeline so that people would see your name and know that you were still active, even though you weren't putting out a new book for a while. Yeah. These are new books because nobody's read them. And in Burn What Will Burn, fabulous language, really enjoyable to read.
It really moves.
And he's got such a quirky way of looking at things.
It's an advantage. It's an advantage to have a quirky character through which to view the world, and as I said, to kind of through which to indulge in a kind of language that's not conventional or typical. I haven't really written my alter ego character yet. I'm thinking probably the Iceland book. The protagonist of that is a conventional chief inspector, and there again he finds, you know, there's a body, but he's there on purpose because he's a policeman. And he is actually my age because I'm just turned 58, and he's kind of going through the same life experiences with elderly parents and divorce and et cetera, et cetera. But most of my characters are not me, so Bob Reynolds is not me, and Rodeo Garnett was not me either. Mm-hmm. But when you inhabit these characters, it really gives you an opportunity to kind of indulge in other facets of your personality that you wouldn't normally, including the kind of language that Bob uses. And it's really been gratifying to me, particularly since it's the kind of book that it is, and it's a tidy little tight book, it's a really compact read, that there aren't a lot of wasted words in it, even though it's from first person, you know. And people seem to enjoy the lyrical style of it.
Those chimes are really going.
It's like I lived in a place and I was always complaining about the children laughing too loud.
It's very.
What kind of person are you that you complain about children laughing too loud? And I said, I think you call me a curmudgeon or a misanthrope. There are words to describe me.
Yeah.
I'm like, what are those damn kids laughing all the time for?
Well, the chime is very zen. My guess is Mackenzie. His book is Burn What Will Burn. And speaking of burning what will burn, you kind of have a running dangerous gag in this story. I was reminded of there's a series by an Irish writer named Adrian McKinty where he's got this this Northern Ireland cop who every time he comes out of his house, he looks underneath his car for bombs. And your gag is you've got this sheriff, and every time we run into him, it's bone dry, and he's throwing his lit cigarette out the window.
Yeah. And when I live... When I lived in Arkansas in the mid-80s, I went to 10 different colleges and universities, I think 7 or 8 before I got my undergraduate degree. So I worked in chicken factories, and I did all these kinds of jobs to get through school. I put myself through undergraduate career, and I moved to Arkansas. I would often just show up the first day of registration with my transcripts in hand and my checkbook, because you could go to school then, you know, for $800 a semester, and just enroll. But I wound up in this place in Russellville, Arkansas, one August, and it was 104 degrees and burn notices everywhere. And I registered for school, then realized I didn't have any place to live. I was literally kind of pulled up in my truck, and I wound up in this trailer, and there was a guy that lived next door to me, and he did this. He would sit out outside of his trailer and smoke cigarettes and throw them out into the yard where one spark would have ignited, you know, the trailer park would have been gone in about 2 seconds. So there again, that's somebody that I actually did live around.
Hmm. So did you work for Tyson?
I did. Uh-huh. I worked for Tyson. I worked for a lot of different people. I worked with a lot of Marshall Island people. They had just moved into Arkansas in the mid-'80s to do poultry processing. It is adjudged to be the worst job in America.
And
that's
imagine.
Pretty much how I got through the last couple of years of my undergraduate career.
And in this book, you've got a chicken factory. And,
over in Danielle's, which is Dardanelles, if anybody knows that area, the sand lizards.
Okay. And you alluded
which
to the
where the pro golfer John Daly is from, so I'll give a shout-out to John Daly because I'm sure he's a big fan of WYSO.
John Daly, man, he's one of a kind. He's from Arkansas, huh?
He is one of a kind. He is the number one Arkansas dude, my friend. He really, really is. That's why I'm saying I'll get his name out there, and they say if you're around him and he knows you're from Arkansas, it's free drinks all night. So,
well, we have just enough time. You alluded to your serial killer, I believe it was serial killer fashion book. And you have a background as a model. You actually were a model in places like Italy. Tell us about that part of your life.
Yeah, that's a part of my life that's in the winking away distant past now. And when I say things, when I do tell people that I was a fashion model, they look at me rather skeptically. So it's sort of like, too, you know how athletes get much better as they get older?
Right.
You know, former athletes. So I have to convince people that, I actually was a model. And they're like, I don't know. You look like the grandfather of a model, maybe. But, I lived all over Europe. I lived in Europe for 3 years, and I worked in Miami and worked out of Dallas and worked all over, and that was my job. And the modeling serial killer book is called The Model Tribe, and it really is about the gypsy lifestyle that we all led. I mean, that's what we did. We were kind of itinerant workers. We were migrant labor of a sort, and we often worked without papers and kind of under the table. And And a lot of people were in that business as they are in acting or the arts and writing. Marginally, there's a really marginal community. There were these people that made hundreds of thousands of dollars. And then there was a little bit of mid-list like me. I was the same position in the fashion industry as I am in the writing industry. I was a solid, mid-list, low mid-list model. I mean, I worked for big people. I worked for Armani and the Zegnas and all kinds of people. I did 40 shows in Milan. I was in all the fashion magazines, but earning money, I made enough money to make a living, and as I hope to do writing, but you understand what mid-list writers go through to try to make a living doing this. So
yeah,
it's kind of glamorous on the outside when I tell people, because I don't have a regular job anymore except as a novelist. And people ask me if I make a living, and I go, I'm getting close to making half a living.
Well, good luck with that, and we really appreciate your time today.
Vic, I always appreciate talking to you. I really enjoy it.
The book is Burn What Will Burn. It's a page-turner from C.B. McKenzie, who has been my guest on the program today. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McKunis. Thanks for listening.